Welcome to Warships Pod, and my special guest for this episode is Mike Hurley, a veteran submariner who also served in surface warships during the, shall we say, early part of the Cold War, the contest between the Soviet Union and its Warsaw Pact allies and NATO. So that's just for people who may not know what the Cold War is, but you know, it was an amazing contest spread over quite a few decades. So Mike, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
And I wonder if we could start off with just asking a simple question. What made you join the Royal Navy, or were you a national serviceman?
No, I wasn't national service. I was in for 7 years. I think it was just family circumstances at the time, and I decided I wanted to do something different. And so I literally turned up at a recruiting office and signed on.
How old were you at the time?
I was not quite 18. I joined in the March when I was 17 and three quarters.
And what made you decide that you would pick the Royal Navy?
I think I had wanted to be in the Merchant Navy, but because I wore glasses, that wasn't possible. But I was able to get into the electrical branch of the Royal Navy.
So did you see yourself as being attracted to life under the sea, or were you just happy to accept whatever the Navy could offer?
I never even thought about submarines. I was very lucky. My first popper ship was HMS Superb, our cruiser. And our first voyage was the American and West Indies, where we spent just over a year in the States, South America, the Caribbean, the Falkland Islands, and so on. And that was fantastic. I then was promoted to leading electrical mechanic and went to Collingwood for the 6 or 8 months course. And I was surrounded in my mess hut by submariners. And they persuaded me that it was a much more worthwhile job and I really ought to join them. And that's when I volunteered.
What year was this? I mean, just to give us the context.
1956, that was.
Right. So this was 11 years after the Second World War. And to just go back a little bit to HMS Superb. Superb was a World War II era cruiser. So the Navy that you joined in the 1950s, and just to give us some context about what comes next, the routine in a cruiser, was Superb an old-fashioned ship? And was it a particularly harsh introduction to the Navy? Was it very basic?
Looking back, it probably was, but no. I mean, clearly, although I think the spotty boys who were 17, 18, 19 didn't really fully appreciate many of the people around them, officers, senior rates and things, had in fact served right through the Second World War. And indeed, my own petty officer, who was an excellent guy and became a chief, he had joined the Navy in 1937. So he was a full-time petty officer, a chief, and was a great guy, and never really mentioned his experiences.
And so with those people around you, and as you say, they didn't really mention their experiences, were the people that were, shall we say, promoting life in a submarine, were they unusually chatty? I mean, were they on some sort of secret mission to snare people in a submariner's net?
Now, I think what I was talking about was HMS Superb. In terms of the submariners, no, these were just colleagues who couldn't believe that anyone would really want to stay on the well-disciplined surface ships. And they thought it was much more exciting, much more interesting, much more friendly. And also, they felt more worthwhile than being one of 500 crew on a cruiser.
And where did you join the submarine service? Was that at Gosport?
Yeah, Dolphin. Yeah, so I did my submarine training there in October, November 56. Then after the training, I joined the spare crew on HMS Adamant, which by coincidence happened to be in Portsmouth Knot, up on the Clyde. And then I had my first submarine, which was HMS Andrew, the same class of boat as the one in the Royal Navy Museum. And I was only on her for 2 or 3 months, and then back to spare crew. And then I joined Taciturn in May, June 1957. And I was on her for close on 2 years.
And how radically different was life in a submarine to what you'd experienced in the cruiser?
Very different, but not necessarily negative. It was very different, and it was a much smaller crew. And very quickly, you knew everyone. If not on chatting terms, at least you knew everyone from the captain downwards, and pretty well they knew you too. So it was a totally different environment. there was still discipline, but it was an informal discipline, and a lot of it was a self-discipline too.
So HMS Taciturn is a diesel electric submarine, a small vessel compared to a cruiser, a much smaller crew. So this was a completely different way of life, wasn't it? I mean, and did you find that you soon adjusted to it?
Yes, I think I struggled a bit on Andrew, but I think I was very lucky when I joined Taciturn, because I had to join in a hurry. They were literally, they had the gangplank out waiting for me and my kit bag. And the chap waiting for me was the petty officer electrician who had been on my course the previous year and been one of the people who had persuaded me to join submarines. And subsequently, he'd been promoted to petty officer. And he was a very good petty officer, very patient, very helpful. And I settled down with him very quickly.
And basically, what was your job on board? What were you tasked with doing on, let's say, a daily basis?
Well, the electrical branch was really responsible for the batteries and the driving power when dived of a submarine, the motor room. So as the leading hand, I was responsible mainly for the motor room and also, like all the electrical crew, dipping the batteries and topping them up and all sorts of things, you know. And bear in mind, batteries on a submarine, each cell is about, comes up to about my shoulder. So it's about 4 foot odd in size, massive batteries. You know, so a lot of maintenance required.
And basically, without your work, your expertise, keeping the batteries in good condition and making sure all the power was supplied, then the submarine was basically just a useless thing floating around in the water, wasn't it?
Yes. I mean, I should have also said anything electrical was our responsibility. So motors, fans, pumps, et cetera, you know.
They were clearly, Taciturn was eager to have you on board. They were waiting for a very important person, that was you, to get there so they could go off on a mission, on a deployment. So what were the kind of things that Taciturn was routinely tasked with?
Exercising with the fleet. Exercising with, I think they were frigates, it could have been destroyers in those days, in hunting submarines, exercising with the Royal Air Force who were looking for submarines, basic peacetime activities most of the time, keeping the fleet on its toes.
And where did you live? Where were you put? I mean, I've been on board just one active diesel submarine in my time, which was a Upholder class. That was alongside. And I've visited HMS Alliance and also been seen nuclear submarines. So they differ in size and capacity. So what was your living space? Where were you put?
When the submarine was at sea, or if we were visiting a foreign port, we lived aboard. The time hadn't arrived at that stage when you lived in a hotel if you were in a foreign port. We lived aboard. If we were next to our depot ship, which was the Adamant, we lived on the Adamant and just worked on the submarine. So a large part of the time we lived on the submarine. And with 70 men, and we'll come on later, I'm sure, to the, when we had 90-odd, but with 70 men, it was reasonable.
So Taciturn did those routine tasks with the fleet. But of course, that kind of submarine was specially adjusted, rebuilt, shall we say, a World War II design that was then extended and given extra battery life and room and special equipment to do a special kind of operation. So although probably some details of that kind of thing are still considered to be slightly secret, there's plenty within, I think, the daily life of somebody on one of those deployments into the North Atlantic, I think is fascinating. And so can you take us through what it was like from your point of view as a junior rating aboard Taciturn when she went on one of those missions up into the North Atlantic?
Yes, I mean, I've only recently discovered that they're now called special operations. I think we thought that we knew what we were, where we were going, but I think we thought subsequently they were Cold War operations, but they weren't. It was very, very different to a normal operation. I mean, totally different. First of all, we took aboard around about 20, 22 extra crew. So suddenly a crew of 70 was a crew of 1992. And the space in any case was cramped. So suddenly we were very cramped. In addition to that, I mean, the additional crew were made up of Russian-speaking telegraphists, some specialist officers, some intelligence officers, some sound specialist officers. And so we clearly were going to places where we were going to be listening. Some of it quite legal, outside the 12-mile limit. Some of it, I'm sure, wasn't. So the whole mission, the whole operation was totally different to what we would normally be experiencing. So, for example, they padlocked our radio, so it was impossible, even by accident, for us to send a signal. We could receive, but we couldn't send. They took off all our ropes and safety buoys and everything else so that they couldn't break loose in embarrassing circumstances. But apart from that, we also had extra equipment aboard. There was a machine that I was operating and was trained to operate called, and the letters stand for something that I don't think I can remember, but it was called HUSK, H-U-S-K, hydro something, but I've forgotten. And so that was used to listen. But I think really what you probably are more interested in, and probably we're allowed to talk about more clearly, are what were living conditions like on a diesel electric boat in 1957 with 90-odd crew aboard.
Yes, yes, yes. I mean, the just to give the listeners some context before we delve into that, what Taciturn was doing was, and this is no secret at all, it's well out there, including my book and others, is into listening to, trying to possibly photograph and basically spying, that's the word, the common usage word to put on it, spying on the activities of the Russian Northern Fleet. You said it's separate from Cold War operations. Like, yeah, that's right, because as is, you know, well known, certain submarines would be sent up with what was called special fit, and this was early special fit, I guess. And so just so listeners understand the context before we plunge into the dasput grimness of it all, that's what you guys were doing. And your job was to stay hidden in a diesel electric submarine, which is no mean feat, for a number of days. But before you tell us about the conditions on board, and I'll quiz you about that, you as somebody in the electrical department and a junior rating at the time, did you know anything about what was actually happening at all?
Yes, we did. We knew it was a special trip. And on day two, the captain came on and told us all he could tell us, which was basically what you've just said. The chart table had a cover over the top of it, or drop down in front of it. And we were told we were not allowed to have a look at the charts. Yes, you're right. I mean, we stayed dived, snorting every day for, I think, 30 odd days, which, as you rightly say, in a diesel submarine is a long time, you know, and had the normal problems that you have in that type of machinery, you know, at times, including on our first trip, an annoying noise, which sounded like something was loose. And as one of the intelligence officers said, we might as well tow a bell behind us. And so we actually had to take a great deal of trouble to find what this was. And I don't think we ever totally successfully did on that trip.
So snorting, which we've had discussed by other people on previous podcast episodes, was using a snorkel to pull in air and vent diesel exhaust fumes so you could charge the battery. So did you play a key part in that?
I played the normal electrical role. I mean, so that when we were snorting, we only really snorted to charge the batteries. So we ran the diesels and then ran the generators. And that was very much a part of the electrical branch. And it was part of the duties in the motor room to supervise what was going on. And during the course of that, to constantly dip the batteries to let the captain and the officer of the watch know how much we had already got into the batteries.
That's something I wouldn't wish to mystify our listeners about too much. You've mentioned it a couple of times. What was dipping the batteries?
Well, the batteries are all stored forward of the control room under the accommodation. And so there's four huge batteries there. And there are little holes in the deck outside the accommodation in the passageway, a little bit like holes that you see people fishing on in the ice. And you have to lift the hole up, you lie flat on your stomach, and you have a hydrometer, which you now put down into the battery. You take a reading, you look at the reading with your torch, which if you hadn't got it red out, red so that it was not a white light, you would be shouted at from the control room. And then having done that on the four batteries, you then went into the control room and wrote the results up on a chalkboard. Bear in mind, this was 1957, so that the captain and officer of the watch could, at a glance, know how much charge we've got into the batteries. In passing, can I just say that if at the time you were lying flat on your face, dipping a battery, a diving station was called, before you could move, everyone was pouring out of the messes to run to their diving station situations, and you were absolutely trampled on if it happened. The other thing that used to happen also was, because it was pitch dark, the hydrometer would sometimes splash you with battery acid, and so my uniform was full of holes.
Listening to you there, and I know we're going to get into this now, that rushing around for diving stations just will remind people, and obviously quite a few of the people listening to us now will have seen Das Boot. And I must admit, when I first read some of the stuff on your exploits in the Royal Navy Submarine Museum archives, I was immediately reminded of the grimness and the activities of Das Boot. So can you take us through some of the, I won't say highlights, but the highlights and lowlights of life in a diesel submarine in that kind of grim environment?
Yes. I mean, I think we need to put it into context, because we are talking about 66, 67 years ago. In fact, I realised recently, Taciturn was closer to Queen Victoria than it is to now, because Victoria died in 1901, so we were 56 years away from her, and we're now 67 years away from Taciturn. And the other thing, of course, is that civilian life today is dramatically different to what it was in 1957. So putting it into context, having said that, yes, I don't think we ever thought of it as being grim. It was just life on a diesel electric submarine in the 50s. And of course, the special operations just made it worse. So we had 90 people crammed into the space where 70 were supposed to live. We did a lot more snorting and dived than we would normally have done. So some of the effects of that were condensation, which the further forward you went, the worse it got. So in the fore ends, where there were a lot of bunks, it was a steady drip when we were down for any length of time. So I used to put a towel over my bunk, and I honestly, there were the odd occasion, not every time, the odd occasion when I could wring it out afterwards, it was so damp. The other thing that would happen when you're snorting is that if the weather up top was not good, the snort mask would be dipping underneath the waves, and therefore for a split second there would be a vacuum. And one could hear all the tins of food and fruit and everything else popping, but one's ears were doing the same thing. And so if you woke up in the morning or whenever, when you were going on watch, you often had a splitting headache. Not always, just sometimes.
Yeah, you mentioned tins of fruit there. That's a very interesting bit, which possibly I hadn't thought about before. But that was because to go on a mission into the north, a very long mission where you'd be away from home, no home base, no chance of resupply because you had to stay hidden under the sea, then there'd be an extra deck, I believe, created below your feet in the submarines, so that would be stuffed with tinned food, wouldn't it?
Yes. What always amazed me was we did have an extra deck, which slowly disappeared as we ate the food. But what was surprising to me was the fact that the coxswain knew where the food was, and so that by and large, he knew where it was stored and knew where the puddings were and the savouries and so on. Although occasionally, because of the damp, we had to have a guess at it because all the labels had come off.
Right, so that must have been quite a surprise to the palate. In terms of food overall, what was that like? Was there any fresh food at all after a few days?
In truth, no, there wasn't. The Royal Navy stores had this brilliant idea on our first trip in 1957, because plastic bags were, believe it or not, brand new in those days. And so they had this brilliant idea. This was the way to make sure that submarine crews had fresh vegetables with them. And so we took aboard hundreds of chopped cabbage in plastic bags. And it won't surprise anyone today to know that within 5 or 6 days, it was slowly going rotten. And the smell in the fore ends, and then in the forward mess, and then in the senior rates mess, and then eventually in the wardroom, was just awful. When it reached the wardroom, so the rumour was, we had to do something about it. And I cannot remember in truth what we did, because we didn't have anywhere to get rid of it. The tradition in the submarine service often was to fire it out of an empty torpedo tube, but ours weren't empty on these trips. And so I think we stuck the lid up just above the waves, and literally, and I know that today people will just cringe at the thought of black bags going over the side, but that's what we did. We got rid of the smell that way. And I think we did a short blast of diesel for like 3 or 4 minutes to clear the boat of air, get fresh air in. But in terms of food generally, you just get used to it. I mean, bread went fairly quickly. I mean, but we made it last as long as we could. And so that we used to cut the green away from the outside and eat the inside. And then eventually we would make our own bread if we had enough battery power.
Right. So that's the food side of it. I mean, we haven't gone too deeply into that, but that's fascinating stuff. What about the general conditions? I've written another book, a submarine history book, in which I've encountered this elsewhere as well. But I did the story of U-47, which was Gunter Preen's U-boat, going to attack the Royal Oak at Scapa Flow, which was a bit like a secret mission like the one you did. And they would, apart from lying on the seabed, they were lucky enough to have shale to nestle the submarine into, the U-boat into. They also would, to conserve air and electricity, etc., would shut things down, systems down, and send people to their bunks. So was that something that you had to do? Were members of the crew sent to their bunks to conserve air, etc.?
Yes, very much so, particularly when we were on billet on our station and we were sometimes unable to charge the batteries properly. And on the odd occasion at all. And so absolutely the air got really bad. And I remember being shaken for one watch. And what they were doing was they were shaking people separately, making them move onto watch. And people coming off watch were told, go straight to your bunk and stay in your bunk. And no moving around the boat at all until we can do something about refreshing the air in the boat. But also, of course, if you're moving about and doing things, repairing things, walking about, you're using oxygen. So, yes, and in terms of lighting, absolutely every unessential light will be turned off. Yes, no question about that. I think one of the things that sort of touches on this as well is the hot bunking that went on. So whereas under normal circumstances, we'd have a bunk each, we found with the extra crew that we had two bunks for three people. And so, therefore, you came out of one bunk, went on watch and came off watch and went into a different bunk. And initially, even as submariners, we were all very fastidious and took our bedding with us. But after 5 or 6 days and being woken up when you're off watch for diving stations and then going back off watch again, it got so complicated. There were times I wasn't sure which bunk I was supposed to be going into, and we couldn't care less at that stage. We just literally went into the spare bunk, and we weren't bothered whether it was warm from the previous guy or whatever. We wanted to sleep. So that was one of the things that would definitely happen, one of the conditions that would definitely happen.
Right. So one thing I think I picked up in researching the activities of cold war submarines such as Taciturn was, am I right in thinking this was your submarine where it was so cold up there in the Arctic off in the international waters off the main Russian bases, the main Soviet Navy bases, that there was ice forming on the inside of the submarine around the hatches?
Not around the hatches. The one place where we really did get ice, especially when we got close to the ice itself, was when we were snorting. So we're sucking down Arctic air that comes down just after the control room straight into the engines. And then the engines then drive the motor. So I could be standing 30 feet in the motor room, just wearing my normal kit. And the engineers at the forward of the diesel engines are there in full Arctic kit, and on the engine room door, there's 6 inches of ice. Of course, the humorous engineers, when I was going forward to dip the batteries, would try to engage me in some sort of lengthy conversation. So I was standing there in my normal gear, and they were in their full gear with gloves, the whole lot. But yes, we got ice then. I've not any recollection of having ice anywhere apart from there.
Right. Did you just say guns? They had guns or
gloves?
Gloves. I did wonder if they were armed, you know, in case there was some sort of mutiny on board at the conditions.
No,
you know? Right. Okay. So
now they were wearing gloves to protect their hands from the Arctic ice that was pouring past them.
Okay. So one of the compensations for anybody in grim times, it's a staple thing in fiction and fact about the Second World War or anything else set in the 40s and 50s is people smoking. But I can't think of a worse environment to have a smoking habit than a diesel submarine that can't actually get any fresh air.
I was lucky. I never have smoked, but I would have said that 85% of the crew smoked. And so therefore, smoking was allowed, apart from when we were charging the batteries, because at a certain point, the batteries give off a ignitable gas. And again, we would know when that was by our dipping of the batteries. And we had the control of that up in the motor room so that we could switch on the no smoking lights, which was not a popular thing to do, particularly as a non-smoker. We get the crew sometimes, if we weren't diving stations, the crew could move about the boat and they would come sneaking aft and ask how much longer. But yes, you're absolutely right. Smoking in a submarine is unbelievable today. I mean, you can't believe it, but pretty well everyone did it. And that was the way of life, I think, in the 50s.
And another thing that was a custom in the Navy of your era and just a little bit later was, of course, the tot of rum. Did you still get your tot when you were on such missions?
Yes, we did. Pretty well the same routine. I mean, again, obviously, operations affected whether it was exactly at noon or not. Certainly, we got the tot every day. And also, that was my first experience. And I think early days for the Royal Navy, we actually got a can of beer a week, every Sunday night, a can of beer, which I know became the routine right through the Navy after that. So we had our can of beer on a Sunday, and if it was possible, and it sometimes was, we would see a 16mm movie up in the forends.
Were there any particular favourites that got worn out when you could see those? I know other submarines where they particularly liked a particular movie and they watched it so much it became blank. So what were the kind of movies that they showed you?
To be honest, I can't remember. They were the typical sort of 1950s movies, I think. I don't think there were any submarine movies, that's a certainty, or probably any war movies. But no, I really can't remember. I do know that we took a lot with us and we brought a lot back that we hadn't seen.
Yeah, I mean, probably it's best just as well you didn't have any war movies or submarine movies. That'd be probably be a little bit too much, wouldn't it? So we've done smoking, we've looked at the food and some of the other general conditions. So one of the things that I could think would also be a problem would be water. Have we talked about water? I mean, was water rationed as well?
Water became rationed. Again, we had the same problem, 90-odd people. We were using too much water, and everyone from the first lieutenant, the captain, the chief stoker, everyone tried to reduce water. So on the second trip, we had a beard competition, and there was no wet shaving at all. And we immediately thought this was not fair because Lieutenant Commander Lucas, one of the intelligence officers, had a huge black beard, but the captain wisely made him the judge. But yes, we were short of water, but I think you get used to that. And I used to, before they put the no wet shaving, I could wet shave from a mug of water. So we all had our own methods, but eventually even that wasn't allowed. They used to switch the water off at certain times in the day. But that was one of the minor problems, I think. I don't think it affected us that much. We were just dirty, unhygienically unwashed, just dirty submariners.
Typical what they call dirty boat submariners, then. That's what you were you? But I would think that if washing wasn't a serious problem, that if somebody had an illness on board when you're all closed up and you're hiding from the Russians up in the Arctic, was that something that you could deal with? Did you have a doctor on board?
We didn't have a doctor, and we didn't have a sick berth attendant. So there was no qualified person aboard a vessel with 90 odd people aboard and a long way from home. I don't think it was thought about. No submarines in those days, before nuclear submarines, had any medical staff aboard at all. We were lucky, apart from colds and bits and pieces like that, we didn't have any serious problems. I got a boil on the back of my neck, and I had a cold as well, which wasn't surprising, bear in mind the conditions and also the diet. And I went to see the coxswain, who was the senior rating aboard, and he was a dedicated medical person, being on a course or two. And he looked at it and decided that my boil needed lancing. And this conversation was taking place at the entrance, the very small entrance of the senior rates mess, with just a curtain across, which they pulled back. They were sitting in there reading, smoking properly, just doing normal things. So he got a needle out, in fairness, put boiled water over it. In the meantime, he was also smoking the whole time and lanced my boil, which immediately squirted all over their table, disgusting as it may sound. And there was very little upset. They sort of mopped it up and said, oh, coxswain, oh, God's sake, coxswain. And that was it. And in fairness, my boil went down, but the scar, absolutely truthfully, I can show it you, is still there.
Right, so that sounds pretty grim. And I hesitate to go into another grim area here, but I know it's a feature of submarine operations, as it is with human beings. And maybe we ought to issue a trigger warning here for sensitive souls. But surely also with 90 people inside the big steel tube, there was also a problem with poo, shall we say. I mean, that's something that I think it occupies the activities of people running complex systems to evacuate all that kind of stuff. Because if the heads get the toilets, as landlubbers would call them, but if the heads get bunged up, then it could lead to a surveillance operation actually being called off, couldn't it?
I've never thought of them getting bunged up, but it certainly, on taciturn, on a long trip with 90 people, where we were trying to stay concealed, was a problem. Later, diesel electric boats had a holding tank, and that almost solved the problem. So everything that went into the loo went into a holding tank, and when they got back, they got rid of it from it was taken out of the holding tank. We had no holding tank. So our method of getting rid of the debris, as it were, was to, when you went to the loo, there was a gauge there which told you how much air pressure you needed to blast it out from the submarine into the sea. And so you close one valve, put sufficient pressure on it, open the outside valve and blasted it out, and then close the outside valve. There was the occasional accident. And generally speaking, it was by somebody who was new to submarines or a guest aboard. And there was a peculiar sound when it blew inwards instead of outwards. So instead of opening the outside valve, they put the pressure on and then they'd opened the inside valve. In other words, the way where you'd hidden the poo, and it just came blasting up. And that was a peculiar whooping sound. And that happened on taciturn on our first trip. And everyone knew what had happened straight away. And there's a huge, great cheer from all the mess decks, I think. Maybe not the wardroom, I'm not sure. But and out of the heads became, of all people, the intelligence officer, decorated by his own poo. And so, yes, the other problem with having to blast the heads is it makes a noise. So if you are a Russian ship or a Russian submarine and you're listening in, you will hear the noise of the heads being blown. The other problem is that you can only blow them down to a certain depth. I cannot remember the depth, but I think it was around 100, 120 feet. And so in those circumstances, which happened a lot on taciturn on those special operations, you can't use the heads because they're full. And so you then have to start using other methods of storing poo. And so 7-pound tins of baked beans and tomatoes and salads and so on are slowly filled up and spread around the four heads aboard the boat. And this just adds to the whole complexion of the submarine in terms of the smell.
Right.
But that was life aboard a diesel electric submarine in 57, 58.
And of course, beyond all this and the daily effort to keep things running, to conserve the battery, to keep people fed, watered, and to somehow cope with all their expulsions, so we say, the submarine was tasked with operations. So did you, we've talked about whether or not you had any idea where you were, did you have any method at all of gaining a clue as to what was actually happening? I mean, were you able to go into the ops room and see people on the periscope doing things? And, you know, you say you couldn't look at the chart, but did you have any means of knowing the location of Taciturn?
Not exactly, no. I think there was a fair amount of good guessing as to where we were, and some bad guessing. We, on the second trip, the junior rates decided if they couldn't look at the charts, they'd keep their own charts. So on an atlas, every time the guy from the junior rates came off the wheel, he would tell us the courses he'd been steering, etc. And we tried to keep a look of it on the atlas. I think it was when we were about 200 miles inside Norway that we realized that we weren't doing a very good job. But the captain one day came up to see also, because he wanted to check how good we were. And had a look at our chart, but said nothing other than well done. But yeah, I mean, I think people did know where we were because of what we were doing aside from living on the boat. So we weren't just sitting there living and the officers were just moving the boat about. We were listening in on special gear. We were making recordings. In fairness, the Russian telegraphists who were based with us were amazingly good at keeping quiet about what they were doing. So we didn't learn anything from them, even though we tried. But you just knew because of listening into various Russian ships, various submarines. And you also knew because of the instructions about silent routine, so that when we were creeping in closer, we were very much in silent routine. So, no, I couldn't show you on a chart, but I could show you the general area.
Yeah, so you mentioned the Russian telegraphists and the intelligence officer. I mean, these were people that were added to your ship's company or the crew, and they were people who were either, ex-Warsaw Pact, like ex-Polish or other people who'd defected or managed to escape the grip of the Russians at the end of the Second World War, or they were Royal Navy telegraphists that were trained in the Russian language? Would that be accurate to say?
Yes. I think there was only one Warsaw Pact person aboard on both trips. He was officially Lieutenant Commander Lucas. I think we all thought it was Lukaszewski. But his English was very good. His knowledge was amazingly good. And of course, we would hear because he had to do this openly in the control room. So the aircraft flying over, he would be on the periscope and would immediately explain what they were, where they were from, etc., etc. So he was really good. In terms of the telegraphists, they were all Royal Navy telegraphists. And they were all had been on the 1-year Russian course, which wasn't just teaching Russian, it also taught the culture, the everything about Russia. The intelligence officers, I have no idea where they came from. For most of them, I've absolutely no idea, but they were civilians, civilian intelligence officers. There were also a couple of Royal Navy officers who were specialists in their areas, ASDIC, sound, whatever. So apart from, I suspect, Lieutenant Commander Lucas, the rest were all either civilians attached, no doubt, to one of the intelligence agencies, or they were Royal Navy personnel on a special trip.
Yeah, so, I mean, that sounds like the Alistair MacLean book, Station Zebra, or Zebra, whatever you want to call it, where they had a few specialists on board for these sort of missions. So, I mean, that's not something that it's beyond the imagination of anybody to guess. And it's out there that these special people were assigned to submarines. But the Russians wherever you were up there in the north, in the Arctic, in international waters or wherever, around the corner off Norway, and I'm just speculating here, they were the sort of people who didn't take kindly to intruders coming into the front yard or the backyard or their own area, were they? So did you ever have any close calls in Taciturn, like the Russians seemingly getting close and maybe using low power depth charges, which is one of their tactics?
Well, in answer to the general question, there was a lot of times when we were very close to the Russians, and they were very close to us. And indeed, on one particular night, which I think ruined our first trip, on one particular night, we were snorting, which is very difficult then for us to hear what's going on around us. And as we broke the snort, we could hear a Russian submarine very close. And when I say very close, I mean 700-800 meters away. They obviously heard us, because very shortly after that, we heard them on the radio, et cetera, et cetera. And after that, there was lots and lots of activity around us. In terms of what you call the small depth charges, which we've called signal charges, yes, there was a few occasions, but one in particular where we had been listening in and we were in amongst the Russian fleet, and we had been listening in, and as you rightly say, at times taking photographs, a bit Heath Robinson, because they sort of attached to our periscope an underwater camera which could be operated from the control room. But by today's standards, it was pretty basic. But anyhow, and on this occasion, we had been dived listening and we came up to periscope depth, and the captain was doing an all-round sweep, and coming straight at us from astern was a Russian destroyer, again, several hundred meters away. And he immediately flooded Q, which is the emergency tank, and we go down quickly. But he also, and I have to say, it was amazing what he did within 20 seconds. Defense state one, so all watertight doors are closed. And he also had the ability and that pressurized moment to say off headphones, because he'd heard the charges being fired. And so we were then had three or four really loud explosions. And the captain again came straight back on again and said those were not depth charges. They were signal charges. They were asking us to surface, which we will ignore. And we then went into silent routine. We then went down to over 200 feet. And they tried to find us. And we just lay there for quite a long time. And they didn't find us, you know. And that probably was, in all honesty, the only time that I sensed any tension in the crew.
Right.
Which is not surprising.
No, I could see that, yeah. More than a little. So the captain, he would keep you briefed on the tannoy or the PA system. Is that what he did in those circumstances?
Yes, pretty well. Yes, he would. He would say what his intentions were, why we needed to keep quiet, why we weren't going to have a hot meal, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, he was very good at that, very much in touch with communications. And also, he said on that particular occasion that we were hard up against the 12-mile limit and we were not going to go any closer in because of the circumstances, because we weren't sure what they would do if they found us within their territorial waters.
Yes, so I mean, that was part of the game, and not to go into it in too much detail, but staying skirting the Soviet Union's territorial waters was a very important part of it, wasn't it, to avoid any...
Yes.
Diplomatic incidents and things like that. So yes. I believe the special missions like this lasted a number of weeks. How many weeks would you say that you took? So you obviously got to get up there, do the job, and then get back again. So how many weeks in total would you be up out doing this sort of job?
6 or 7 weeks. 4 weeks on the billet where we were supposed to be. And that was pretty accurate. We would be told when we were on billet and we would be told when we were leaving. So, and it was pretty well 4 weeks. And so 10 days, roughly 10 days both ways. And pretty well from when we left the Clyde, which I know is what happens today, pretty well when we left the Clyde, we were dived or we were snorting on the surface sometimes. So we would be locked down below, but we were visible, but we were ready to go straight under. But that was rare. Normally, we would dive straight away and, say, dive for 35, 38 days.
I mean, that's extraordinary. I mean, I can't imagine it. I'm just a civilian, and I've only ever briefly visited submarines at sea at maximum 3 days on a trip. So I can't, and that was a nuclear-powered submarine, so I can't imagine it. So how did you keep going personally? You know, did you have moments of dark introspection, or were you so busy that you didn't really notice it? And so young, so I suppose you were pretty young then, weren't you?
Yeah, I was 22. I personally never had any sort of depression, and I was unaware of anyone else having it. If they did, it was very much within themselves. There was no gossip about somebody not being able to stand the pressure, absolutely none whatsoever. And I think looking back, and even at the time, I was very pleasantly surprised that there were very few arguments, very little irritation. The forward deck, you've got 30 plus young men, all in the age range, 19 to sort of 23, 24. No arguments. I mean, irritations at times because somebody wanted to go into their locker or something, but nothing serious at all. You know, lots of gossip, of course, lots of chattering, lots of rumours, even in a boat which, you know, you could walk from one end to the other in 2 minutes. I mean, there were still rumours about them and so on. But no, most people just accepted the life as it was. And when we were off duty and not at diving stations, we'd play uckers. And you can explain what that is. We would play uckers. We would play cards. We would read. We would occasionally obviously watch the Sunday night film. We would write letters knowing that they wouldn't get posted for 7 weeks, probably arrived the same time as we would home. We just lived life, drank coffee, tea, no fresh milk. So, yeah, life just went on. But I have to say, on the special trips, particularly on billet, we were occupied much of the time. And I think what we wanted to do most of the time we were not on watch and not on diving stations was sleep. Because we had lots of short bursts of sleep. So you'd be on watch, you'd come off watch, you'd be woken to go to diving stations, you'd finish diving station, 45 minutes later, you'd be on watch again. And all you really wanted to do was to get in your bunk, somebody else's bunk perhaps, and sleep.
You mentioned that earlier, you said shake, which maybe some listeners won't understand, ones that have not been in the Navy. But customarily, sailors in, let's say, a normal routine in a surface ship would get an early morning shake, which is somebody, well, they'd hear on the PA that it's call to hands, but also you can get at various times of the day, you can get an early morning shake, or when you've got to go and watch, you get a shake, which is somebody coming around, if you're lucky, with a cup of tea and a biscuit, it then literally shakes you in your bunk to let you know to make sure you're going to be on duty. So did you have to run that yourselves, or did you have people making sure that the young men were getting out of their bunk and getting on with things?
The normal person, both on the special ops and in normal submarine life, the person who would shake you would be the person you were relieving. So there would be two of us on watch in the motor room 24 hours a day. And so the chap coming off watch then would come forward and shake the two people going on watch. That would be it. In terms of the special operations, that pretty well worked, apart from the odd occasion when somebody would be designated by the control room to shake everyone who was due on watch. So it was only one person moving around, again, to conserve energy. But that was pretty rare, to be honest.
Yeah, so you've been at sea for 7 weeks, or dived for 35 days, I think you said, which is extraordinary. And so in your own little world, you're cut off from civilization beyond. So there'd be presumably a point when the submarine was going north when that would cut off completely, or even when you leave the Clyde, let's say, you cut off that link to the outside world, and then you'll renew the link to the outside world. Because, of course, beyond you, your families have been going on about, beyond you, your families have been going around their daily business and not knowing where you are, what you're doing. So you're disconnected from them and they're completely disconnected from you. So when was the reconnection with civilization?
I'm not sure there was a specific point. We couldn't send any messages at all, as I've said, so they couldn't hear anything from us. We could receive messages, and as I think is the situation nowadays with nuclear submarines, only particularly important messages would come through. So our electrical artisanal's wife was expecting a baby, and so that was scheduled to come through at a particular date, and I think it was like 9 days later he got the news. In terms of general communication, it didn't happen until we got alongside Adamant, where there were phones, where we could actually phone back, where there were pay phones on Adamant, so we could phone home. There was the radio, or I should say, in 1957, the wireless, and we would pick that up. We would pick up the BBC Light programme somewhere around the Shetlands, but we had our own system. We had no Wi-Fi, and we had no television, but we did have a sound system, and we did have an ability to play records. But apart from that, we were literally cut off.
So Adamant depot ship was what, in Holyloch or in Gairloch or somewhere like that, was she? I mean, where was Adamant?
Well, we were just at the changeover, really, 1957, yeah. October. The Adamant was normally in, and the submarine depot ships had for many, many years been at Rosse, the Bute Island. But just as we were coming back in October 57, she was due to come up, and that was when Faslane really started. When I was in the Navy, Faslane had a wire fence and was a cinder base, and there was nothing there. I mean, literally nothing there. And I'm not sure at that stage that anyone had any idea of what was going to happen in terms of the nuclear submarines that started in 1960. And now it's a massive base.
And so, yeah, Faslane is today HM Naval Base Clyde, and has expanded hugely, quite an amazing place. So you would come in wherever you came in Scotland, and then presumably Taciturn, a Portsmouth Gosport-based submarine, would then head south, and that was when you'd get reunited with families. Did you have anybody waiting for you on after these deployments?
The modern situation where people are on the jetty waving their loved ones in just did not happen anywhere in those days, really. And even on HMS Superb, there was no one waiting for us when we'd been 13 months away. We did have an open ship about a week later when family could come down. So no, there was no one waiting. And Taciturn wasn't actually a Gosport submarine. We were a Clyde submarine, so that we would go alongside Adamant, and leave would then be organised for half the ship's company for the first 2 weeks, and then following that for the second half. So we'd all get leave, but it would be spread out over a month.
And presumably you couldn't talk about what you'd been doing anyway, could you?
Absolutely not. And I mean, I'm sure some of the threats were empty, but we were told that the security services would place people on trains to listen into our conversation. So don't talk about it, and so, et cetera, et cetera. But quite clearly, it was something that one didn't talk about. And although I wrote, as you know, two diaries, I never spoke about it to my family for at least 25 years after I'd left the service.
Yeah, and I guess it's something that has only in recent times people have come to understand, that submariners did a dangerous and important job there, because you mentioned that the torpedo tubes weren't empty, so you couldn't fire the garbage, the rubbish out of the torpedo tubes. That's because submarines left with war shot torpedoes. So it was a cutting edge part of the Cold War, and getting intelligence on the Russians was a key bit for if it went hot, then obviously the NATO navies would have an edge, hopefully. So when you look back on it, and it's a long time ago now, and you've brought it very vividly to life, that's been fantastic. What's your general reflection on that period of your life?
Oh, I look back with pride now, because I realise that what we were doing was dangerous. I'm not sure how important it was, because I think another a submarine commander in another book did say it was like a 2,000 ton submarine with 80 or 90 men aboard was like a flea on an elephant in terms of Russia. So I have no idea whether the information we brought back was of any use, but we brought back what we were asked to bring back, and we did what we were asked to do. And so, yes, it's a very, very brief period in my life. I'm 3 or 4 years in submarines and I'm 88, but it had an effect on me. And I think it actually did help me eventually in civilian life, because the world was much easier to live in because of 3 or 4 years in submarines. Incidentally, when you were saying about lack of communication, it didn't only apply to our wives and families and children and mums and so on. It also applied to captain submarines and the Admiralty. So they would send a submarine off for 6 or 7 weeks, and they would never hear from it from 6 or 7 weeks. Whereas normally they'd be hearing every day. When we were doing exercises with the fleet, we had to send a signal when we dived, we had to send a signal when we surfaced. So they would know exactly what was happening. So suddenly they've lost one of, assuming it's only us, but they've lost one of our submarines for 6 weeks and they hear absolutely nothing. And so on our way back on the second trip, we had a serious engineering problem, which necessitated us having to go deep, take out the shaft, bring it up into the engine room and do one or two other things and then put it back down again, so that we were late coming back. And Captain Submarines, unusually, actually was waiting for us at the jetty and came aboard, and he was a very relieved Captain Submarines, because he obviously would have been going through in his mind, what do we do if she doesn't come back?
Was that one of two propeller shafts? I mean, that sounds quite amazingly serious. Or was that presumably you had something else to run at the same time?
It was the clutch between the port engine and the generators and motors. And so they had to lift the shaft out, remove the clutch and put it back. And on a floating platform, we went as deep as we could, sensibly deep as we could, so we had a flat platform. But yes, it didn't delay us as long as one would think. I think we were 36 hours delayed, but nevertheless, it I'm sure had both the Admiralty and the powers that be slightly concerned.
Well, it's good to know they were concerned. I mean, it shows you were on their minds, even though you were so remote in so many ways. As a submariner, you said 3 or 4 years you spent as a submariner. So what happened after your time in Taciturn, or what happened after Taciturn completed the last deployment mission that you were involved in? What did you do then?
I became an acting petty officer electrician, and I then did work at Faz Lane on a couple of ships that were going to be used for accommodation. And then I spent a little time on a experimental submarine with hydrogen as fuel. So I was on Excalibur for a time, and then I left the Navy.
Right, that's HMS Exciter, as I believe.
Excalibur. I think there was two of them.
No, that was their nicknames. What I'm saying is, when they called Exploder and Exciter. So was that not a fairly tricky assignment?
I think, you know, at 22, 23, you just take it as it comes. But one was very aware that there was no smoking in that boat.
Yeah, I can imagine. So you came. So when did you actually come out of the Navy?
1960.
And what came next, just to round off this dive into your experiences and your life?
I had the normal two difficult years in civilian street, when I hated all civilians. And then I got a job with a multinational company, which was amazingly good. And I got into management. And then I worked for another multinational company. And then for 18 years, I had my own business, both in this country and then subsequently in Spain with Spanish partners. As I said, I was in the Navy for 7 years, and in Civilian Street for sort of 40 years.
Yeah, but as somebody who'd been a Samaritan on those pretty grueling missions, did you never go to sea again, or did you make sure you never went under the sea?
I never went under the sea again, but as the years ticked by, I did start sailing and did a lot of sailing, both what I recall, coastal sailing, and we went down to the Med, and once we went across the Atlantic to the Caribbean and back to some of the places I've been on Superb. Those are the sort of things that I did. It was offshore sailing. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and it gave me a real thrill the first time I went back to Gibraltar, where I've been on the centre mole in Gibraltar Harbour with Superb, to be in the marina in Gibraltar was really good.
Well, that was a fantastic chat about a very absorbing and fascinating side of the Cold War, which probably a lot of people don't think about. And so I'm very grateful to you, Mike, for coming on to the Warships Pod and taking us with you under the sea in a grungy diesel electric boat. And it's just been fantastic. So thanks for coming on the Warships Pod.
It's been a real pleasure and very nostalgic to think back to those days. Another life. Thank you.
For more Warships IFR, you can visit our website at warshipsifr.com, follow us on Facebook at Warships IFR, and also Twitter at Warships IFR. And we also have a YouTube channel called Warships IFR TV. Thank you for listening, and there will be another episode of the Warships Pod unleashed soon.